heart tonight and just exalt Him. Hallelujah, Jesus. Hallelujah, Jesus. We worship You tonight, God. We praise You, Jesus. You are worthy to be praised, God. Hallelujah, Jesus. You're wonderful, beautiful, glorious, matchless in every way. Wonderful, beautiful.
Tonight. You can be seated. Sunday morning and Sunday night, we had Brother Forkpaugh here. And he'll be leaving shortly to go back to Liberia. He's been here in the States for 13 years, and of those 13 years, he helped found 29 churches. One of those was here. And I'm just very excited. He preached a marvelous message Sunday morning and a very incredible message Sunday night. And we're partnering up with him to build Calvary Gospel Church in Liberia. And we took pledges, and I think it was right around $36,000 of pledge. So excited about that. If you did not get an opportunity to pledge, we do have pledge forms. And you can see the office, Sister Jessica Rivest. Yeah, we'll take care of you there. So we're going to get started tonight. We'd started at the beginning of the year, I started a series, Living a Life of Significance. And talked about stepping into your whatever purpose that God has for your life. We've talked about coasting and coping or conquering. And I want to title in this Living a Life of Significance, I want to title this beginning of this next three messages here, The Power of a Humble Spirit. Now, when you think of humility, a lot of things go through people's minds. And just want to say, tonight we're not going to get a whole lot into humility. We're going to kind of lay out a foundation of humility. But humility and pride, you look at the two, a lot of people feel that humility is the opposite of pride. I was talking with Pastor Seidel today, and humility is considered by a lot the opposite of pride. And then you have meekness in there. And I like to look at meekness as humility, willing to serve. We look at Moses was considered the meekest man on the earth. And I'm not going to get into a whole lot of that tonight. But when we just look at humility and such, we really struggle in our world today because we have a very prideful world that we live in. And it's very hard to find a humble spirit today. Years ago, there was an advertising slogan for an auto supply company. This particular company used Fram oil filters. Anybody here? All the gearheads here, anybody ever use the orange Fram oil filters? That was kind of the filter I'd always use, go get the Fram oil filter. But the old mechanic, there's an old mechanic standing in the shop, and the slogan was, "You can pay me now or you can pay me later." Tonight, as we add on to our series of Living a Life of Significance and the title, The Power of a Humble Spirit, just as the Fram oil man says, "You can pay me now or you can pay me later." If we humble ourselves now, God won't have to do it later. The same principle applies. A wise old man friend who was a man once told me, the price you pay is always the cheapest. The first price that you pay is always the cheapest. And he was very right about that. We work on projects around our house. We work on looking at purchasing things, and most of us, we want to get what is cheapest, what we can get the best bang for the buck. And I found out that sometimes even free deals aren't so free after all. So the price for dealing with our problems and situations, we're going through a 21-day fast. We're really, literally, we're about halfway through that here tonight. And perhaps for some of you, it's just been a real difficult road because you've just found that you've just gotten hungrier and hungrier and hungrier. And you're tired of you're tired of eating beans, tired of eating rice, quinoa, whatever that stuff's called. Looks like maggots on steroids. But anyway, I'm just saying that's what it looks like. But I've learned to love it. You can actually add enough junk to it to make it edible. But you know, the price for dealing, when we look at our problems, when we look at fasting, fasting typically is going to bring out all kinds of things in us that we didn't really even understand and that we had in us. How many of you are having that happen to you? A few of you are. Thank you for being honest. You see, when we look at our problems, the price never goes down, and that's true personally. It's true in our relationships. We put off dealing with our issues because we think it's going to cost too much for us to deal with them right now. We can go through a 21-day fast. We can get halfway through that fast and still be struggling with things, and some of us may end up with the 21 days behind us, and we still are struggling. But you have to understand something, that if we have sin in our lives and we leave that untouched, that sin is not going to diminish, it's going to grow. If it can withstand 21 days of prayer and fasting, it's not going to get smaller. It's established itself in your life, in your heart, in your mind. And it's just like a cancer. If you leave it untreated, it will spread throughout your soul, throughout your mind, throughout your body. You see, we can humble ourselves in the eyes of the Lord, or we can continue to go on living any way we want until a time comes that God decides to humble us. And when God decides to humble us, it's generally a bit more catastrophic than if we take it upon ourselves to determine to humble ourselves before God. So this is a promise of God. Every blessing awaits those that will humble themselves before the Lord. As we enter midway into our fasting, perhaps here tonight, we are in a battle. And this battle is within our flesh. And the spirit begins to seek the upper hand. You can feel that going on in your life. It's only through the process of fasting accompanied by soul-searching prayer that God can reveal to us just exactly what lies within us. As most of us here tonight, our struggles typically are not what we would call a bad sin, what we would look at as a bad sin. You know, those that aren't addicted to drugs, and I know our CIP folks aren't here tonight, and I would say this if they were here anyway, I hope we don't ever look over at them and say, Lord, I'm so thankful I'm not like those over there because I don't have drug problems. I don't have smoking. I don't have drinking. God forbid that I would ever have a problem with any of that. But for the most part, you know, we think about it. You know, I get along with my brothers and my sisters, except when I don't, you know. And it's usually their fault. It's usually something they did. We struggle at times with shortcomings, you know. Lord, I struggle with shortcomings in my life, and sometimes we grow impatient with ourselves. You ever get impatient? You ever get angry at yourself? Anybody here ever just get mad at yourself for just doing stupid stuff? You say, when am I going to stop doing dumb stuff? Yet somehow we continue along this path, seeking to become a better us. At times, perhaps we tell ourselves that we're doing just as good as those around us. And we seek to, at times, to justify our actions, justify our sins. As I was struggling in prayer, and I mean really struggling, not just the sense of not wanting to pray, but I was just having a hard time for whatever reason with my conversation with God. And I have to admit that this fast, it's been a real battle within myself. See, we can go into a 21 days like this with expectations of oneself, with the goals that you desire to achieve. And here, halfway through, you're still struggling because you don't feel like you've met those particular milestones that you wanted to meet. So as I was struggling, I understand the fast is not over yet. So I myself, and perhaps maybe you, if you're in the same boat, you may still reach the desired end of the results. But I was asking God, what keeps a person, what keeps an individual, what keeps a church from having that? We've talked about this a lot, about that spiritual breakthrough in every area of our lives. You see, we can have a breakthrough here on a Sunday night worship service or Sunday morning or Wednesday night. We can have a breakthrough, but we break through in worship. But there seems to be all of these other aspects of our lives that we struggle to break through on. What keeps us from having that breakthrough in every area of our life? As I begin to pray about this, I tell you, God took me down a road, Brother Hawk. I didn't want to go down. Just didn't want to. I sat there, type a little while, get up, walk away, go putz on something, type a little while, get up, go walk away. It was a struggle. And I think the introduction to this study pretty much sums it up tonight. You can pay now, or we can pay later. If we humble ourselves now, God won't have to do it later. So let's begin reading tonight from James chapter 4, verses 6 through 10. But he giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh unto you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. And when you look at this, James is hitting pretty hard here. So when you ask yourself, you know, who was James writing this letter to? He was writing this letter to the Jewish people, more than likely the Jews in Jerusalem that had been converted. And he was writing this letter somewhere at or around or before 60 A.D. History tells us he died approximately 62 A.D. So he was not addressing lost people. He was not addressing unchurched people. Not addressing sinners. He was addressing the church in Jerusalem. Saints just like you and I. And this is what he says. Be afflicted and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. but he giveth more grace. Wherefore, he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. And we're going to continue this study on Sunday a.m. and p.m. as well. So tonight, let's just begin by covering, but he giveth more grace. Wherefore, he saith, God resisteth the proud. That's all we're going to cover tonight. Pride, one could say, is arguably the most deadly and evil of all sins because it's the root of all other sins when you look at it. Pride was no doubt Satan's original sin when he said that I will make myself like the Most High. He wanted to be as God in Isaiah 14, 14. We read in Genesis 3, verses 1 through 6, the story. I'm not going to read it tonight, but referencing that pride was the bait that Satan used to tempt Eve. When he set aside what God had said, and he assured Eve that if she ate of the forbidden fruit, she would be just like God. She said, "Thou sure." He just inserted one little word, "Thou surely shall not die." And he told her that if you eat of this fruit, you're going to be enlightened. You're going to be just like God. You're going to be able to see the world in a much bigger, broader picture. You're going to be just like God. So pride is really self-satisfaction. It's all about self. Satan was thinking about self. Eve here was thinking about self, that if I take of this fruit, I'm going to be like God. We read in Hosea chapter 13, verses 4 through 6, paraphrasing this, when God says to Israel, he says, "I have been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt. I cared for you in the wilderness, in the land of drought, as they had their pasture that became satisfied, and being satisfied, their heart became proud. Therefore, they've forgotten me." This is Israel. They'd been in the promised land. They had forgotten all about Egypt. They'd forgotten all about the wilderness, forgot all about the drought. They had their pastures. They became satisfied. They had the land that flowed with milk and honey. They had their three-car garage. They had their boat. They had their nice manicured lawn. They had their motor homes. They had all of these things that made life comfortable for them. And their heart became proud because they became satisfied. And they forgot God. There's nothing wrong with having all of those nice things unless we forget God. You see, pride is self-sufficiency, and it's about self-reliance. Moses warns the people of God in Deuteronomy 8, chapter 11 through 17, paraphrasing this, about what will happen when they have rest in the promised land. God warns them back all the way in the book of Deuteronomy. He says, "Lest when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply, then your heart becomes proud. And you forget the Lord your God and who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And you say in your heart, my power, my strength is in my hand. You see, I made this money myself. I did this myself. I built this business myself, Brother James. I built this church myself. I built this Sunday school class myself. I built this ministry myself." That was in Deuteronomy that we just read in Hosea, where that all of this came to pass, the culmination of this. You see, pride considers itself above instruction. Pride knows it all. Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 13, 9 and 10, "I will destroy the pride of Judah and the great pride of Jerusalem. This wicked people who refuse to listen to my words, who walk in the stubbornness of their heart." Pride stubbornly refuses to be taught the way of God, and it makes its own wishes the measure of truth. I'm going through these points here. I should have made you aware of that. I'm at point 4. First is pride is self-satisfaction. It's all about yourself. Maybe if Sister Jennifer, if you can put that on the overhead, if you're able to do that. Pride is self-sufficiency and self-reliance. And pride considers itself above instruction because pride knows it all. Pride is insubordinate. Pride is disobedient. Pride is defiant. You see, as we fast, all of these things come out in us. And it can get ugly sometimes, Sister Roz. Thou dost rebuke the arrogant, the cursed that wander from thy commandments. When the commandments of God are spoken, pride turns away. Pride's not liking what you're hearing tonight. Pride doesn't want to submit. It rejects the right and the authority of God to command. Pride takes credit. Pride likes to take credit for what God alone does. It's number five. When the most vivid illustrations of this case, we covered this a month or so ago, was of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. He stood on his balcony and he says, "Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself had built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" It was all about him. And while the word of the king's mouth, while the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, "King Nebuchadnezzar, your sovereignty, your kingdom has been removed from you." And after this season, a space of 1 year of humiliation, of grazing in the fields like an ox, Nebuchadnezzar is restored. And when he's restored, he confesses. And what does he say? He says, "Now I, King Nebuchadnezzar, I praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven. For all his works are true and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride." We have to be very careful, church, because God has blessed us, and God has blessed a lot of you. I've received multiple blessings from God, and I'm thankful for those blessings. But I have to keep my heart in check. You know, one thing else that pride loves is pride loves to gloat. It does. Pride exalts, it gloats, and I like this, the way this is. It wallows in being made much of. Pride loves position. Jesus called out the religious leaders in Jerusalem. "You love the place," he tells them in Matthew 23:6-7. "You love the place at banquets. You love to be honored at your banquets. And the chief seats in the synagogues and the respectful greetings in the marketplace, you love that. You wallow in it. And being called by men, you love to be called rabbi." You see, pride loves to exalt itself. This is kind of hard tonight, isn't it? Isn't this a little hard to take sometimes? Pride aspires to the place of God, just as Satan was in the garden. Pride loves to replace God. That's what drove Satan to his demise, because he wanted to be as God. Pride opposes the very existence of God. That's why we live in a nation right now that has very little to do with God. We've driven God out of our schools. We've driven him out of our workplaces. We can't talk with him. We can't talk about God on the streets in some cities now. Some cities, they won't even allow you to have Bible studies in your home because of city ordinances. We're driving God. Why is that? Because man thinks they know how to rule themselves. You ever wonder? I'm just being very open and honest here tonight. You ever wonder, why do we even vote for some of these goofballs that are in office, Brother James? Either aisle, I don't care anymore. Because they're both, they'll lie, they lie and lie and lie and lie and lie. And you can't tell them that they're wrong. Why is that? Because they're so puffed up on pride. They want to run your life, if you haven't figured that out yet. They want to tell you what to do, when to do it, how to build it, what you can have, what you can't have, what you can eat, what you can't eat. All of this. Why is it? They want to control you, but they don't do so good controlling themselves. Look at the hypocrisy coming out of Hollywood. My word, who's going to take any advice of moral standards from Hollywood? But you see, pride is involved in this. And people jump on the bandwagon. Pride opposes the very existence of God. The wicked in the haughtiness of his countenance does not seek God. All of his thoughts are, there is no God. Psalms 10:4. Pride knows that the simplest solution for its own survival would be that there would be no God at all. Did you get that? The only way that pride can survive and flourish if God is out of the picture. This is why our culture today is in the mess that it's in. We may say we believe, but we don't follow. I spoke of this a few weeks ago on Christian Atheists. I believe it was a Sunday morning. People that believe in God, but they don't follow after what God, they don't believe in, they don't do anything that God would require us to do. That's the world we live in today. We live in a world, Brother Mark, that says, you know what? Christianity, I don't have to do anything to be saved. I don't have to do anything. I hear this, I read this sometimes. All we need is grace. Good luck with that. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. He found it back in the Old Testament. So if all we needed was grace, Noah had it, there would be no reason for God to robe himself in flesh and come to the earth then. If Noah had it in the Old Testament, why do we need it today? Ever think about that? If Christianity is the only religion that doesn't require you to do anything to be saved, why did Jesus even come? Why even bother? You don't have to do anything. What's the point? Live any way you want to live. That's Christian atheism. You see, pride refuses to trust in God. Proverbs 28:25 contrasts the arrogance and trust. An arrogant man stirs up strife. I want to say an arrogant woman can stir up strife too. But he who trusts in the Lord will prosper. Pride tells us that I can't trust God. You see, the posture of trust is too weak. It's too dependent. It calls too much attention to the strength and wisdom of another. Trusting God is the heartbeat of humility. It's the opposite of pride. When pride keeps us from trusting in God to take care of us, then there are two possibilities that lie ahead of us. One is that we feel a false security based on our own illusionary power and perceptiveness, or we just think we're smart. One's an illusion, the other one, I guess it's an illusion too. We just think we're too smart. We're too smart to fail. We're too smart to fall into. We're too smart to, you know, you'll never catch me there. See, when pride keeps us from trusting in God, we have to be careful. The other is that we realize we cannot guarantee our own security, our own safety. And thus we begin to have these feelings of anxiety. We feel anxious. We become worried about everything. Man, I talk to people. It's amazing how many people now, they just seem to be worried about everything. Now, when we look at this tenth trait of pride, and we read about in 1 Peter 5:6-7, or 5-7, it says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. So this takes point 9 and ties in with point 10, because pride is anxious about the future. We get all worked up about tomorrow. We got all worked up about next week, about next month, about next year. We don't even live today properly. We read in Isaiah 51, 12 and 13, even I am who confronts you. Who are you that you are afraid of man who dies and of the Son of Man who is made like grass, that you have forgotten the Lord your Maker? Listen, God has got everything in control. There's nothing that he misses. So who do you think, when you're suffering from anxiety and you're suffering from struggling, who are you afraid of? You see, pride is the root of anxiety. Now, pride is the root of a lot of issues. And this has been such a struggle. Did you know that pride can cause us to filter out the sin in our own lives? Did you know that? On the other hand, it can also cause us to pinpoint the sin in other people. You see, pride is fault-finding. Pride likes to look at your neighbor, likes to look at your brother or sister. Pride likes to pick out all of the things that's wrong with them. You see, this is a common practice. In fact, it was such a common practice that Jesus spoke of this in Matthew 7:5, where he tells us that we need to remove the plank from our own eyes before we focus on the splinter in our brother's. See, pride will tell us that our brother is wrong and that we're right, because it's fault-finding. If we continually focus on the sin in others, it's probably overwhelming evidence that you would have pride in your own life. You see, I want you to listen very closely here. Finding fault is different than lovingly correcting someone. You see, some of us, we're just really good at finding fault with things, but we're not very good about correcting things. You know why we're not good about correcting things? Because we don't want to get our hands dirty. We don't want to get messy. What makes the difference? What makes the difference between finding fault in someone and lovingly correcting someone? Pride is the difference. Pride is what makes the difference. If we find ourselves constantly pointing out the faults of others, perhaps it's time that we take our fingers and point them inwardly and examine our own hearts. Pride is fault-finding. Something else that pride has a harsh spirit. The harsh spirit often follows the fault finder spirit. We like to find fault in our brothers or our sisters. And then we sit at our high and mighty peak, as we spoke of in number 6. Pride likes to gloat, and it loves position. And it's so easy to cast aspersions or to spread a harsh spirit upon those who are struggling. You see, we can often speak of other sin with irritation, with frustration, or judgment. And this is not bred out of a spirit of humility or a connection with our brokenness, as it should be, but it comes out of a place of arrogance. It comes out of a place of pride. You see, this symptom of pride can be very damaging to our families, can be very damaging to our loved ones, and it can be very damaging to the church body. You know, pride also has a very superficial heart. It's really quiet in here right now. Now you know why I had a hard time putting this together. When pride is the ruler of our lives, other perceptions of us become of the utmost importance. Rather than focusing our attention inwardly toward our hearts, we choose to superficially manufacture how we appear on the outside. It's called hypocrisy, church. Rather than focusing our attention inward on our hearts, we choose to superficially manufacture how we appear on the outside. You see, Jesus is not concerned with how we look on the outside. He's not impressed with how many Jesus Fish bumper stickers we have. He's not impressed with how many notes we write in our Bibles. He's not impressed that we have the largest Bible in the entire congregation. He's not impressed that we have a video library of 5,280 DVDs, CDs, whatever it may be, that we can walk in every foot of every mile. We've got a CD or a DVD to watch. You see, God is more concerned about what's going on inside your heart. When pride lives in a heart, we're more concerned. Listen to this. When pride lives in our hearts, we're far more concerned with others' perceptions of us than the reality. We fight the sins that have an impact on how others view us. Listen to this. Write this one down. We fight the sins that have an impact on how others view us, but we make peace with the ones that no one sees. It's real easy, Brother James, when we have visible sin, that we'll fight that sin because it has an impact on how other people view us. But those that we hide so very, very deep in our hearts, it's too hard, Brother Scott, and it takes too much effort, and we can't fast enough and pray enough to root it out. So we make peace with it, and we live with it, and then we wonder why we can't have the breakthrough that we want to have in our lives. This is hard. We have great successes in the areas of holiness because we like to pride ourselves at times in our holiness, because it's high visible accountability. But we have very little concern at times for the disciplines that happen in secret. Now we're going to spend some time when we're finished here in prayer, so I have really one more point to cover. And this is something that's been kind of burning for a while. And that is, pride is the driving spirit behind defensiveness. Now this is going to get really plain here. Someone on the defensive is concerned with justifying their actions or words. Defensive people have a defensive attitude as they try to protect themselves. If you know that to defend is to protect, then you have an idea what defensiveness means. When a person is acting in defense, they're trying to protect or justify themselves. You look at the opposite of defensiveness, or openness, which creates an atmosphere of freedom, an atmosphere of growth, of respect and trust. When we look into the dictionary, and we look at the word a barometer. A barometer is something similar to like a thermometer. A thermometer indicates temperature, a barometer indicates pressure. So when we have a big storm moving in, that's why the fish bite right before the storm moves in. Because the barometric pressure drops. It plummets. And the lower it plummets, typically the worse the storm becomes. So thus the term barometer. The reason it's called a barometer is because it measures barometric pressure. But we as individuals, we have an internal barometer as well. And so many times we sense defensiveness in ourselves or in others. It is a barometer which indicates pride or immaturity in God. You cannot become defensive if you're going to exhibit humility and Christ-likeness. You can't become defensive if you're going to be teachable and you're going to be taught and you're going to allow people to speak and teach into your lives. You cannot be defensive if pastors, elders, teachers, and other brothers and sisters are to have their proper place in our spiritual growth. So we have to ask ourselves tonight an honest and valid question. Am I a person that's a very defensive type of a person? If we get defensive when others point something out in our lives, then we're still perhaps struggling with spiritual maturity. Now listen carefully here. Defensiveness is rooted in pride, and it's shored up with prejudice. Not being willing to be corrected is defensiveness that's rooted in pride. When we look at racism or reverse racism, is being defensive or defensiveness. It's rooted in holding on to racism because you don't want to let it go because it becomes a defense mechanism for ourselves. We talked about some of this on New Year's night when we talked about communion and how diversified the body of Christ is. You see, we're seeking to have a very multicultural church in this community. But sometimes I think multicultural, we really think it just means it's just a multicolored church. Just people of different colors. But there's a vast difference between cultures. There's differences between colors. And there's no reason why in the family of God that we would have to become defensive over that. I love Brother James like a brother because he is my brother. That doesn't just mean that, and I'm just going to get real gritty here, just doesn't mean that black people could be racist, Brother James. Any race can be racist. Any race can be defensive. Doesn't just mean that that's what we hear all the time because that's what we're told all the time. I could be black and I could hate Hispanics. I could be Hispanic and I could hate Norwegians. Nobody hates Norwegians, though. You get what I'm saying here? This is the body of Christ. When I look at you, I don't want anyone to feel defensive or feel the feeling of defensiveness. But see, sometimes we allow defensiveness to rear its ugly head when anybody touches that nerve that's deep down within us, that hurt. Sometimes we carry hurts and we carry bitterness because we want to carry it. Because we've allowed that hurt and we've allowed that bitterness to actually define us and become part of us. God says we got to root all of that out. It's all got to come out. Defensiveness is feeling that when anyone challenges me on something or exposing that I have blind spots they see and I don't. Defensiveness shows itself in touchiness when anyone disagrees with me in any way. There's some people I just, I just try not to disagree with them because it's not worth the battle sometimes. So you just kind of nod your head, listen, and walk on, because you can't speak back in truth, because they will get upset at you. You see, if I'm defensive, then pride is raising its ugly head inside of me. If I'm defensive, I think I know better than anyone else who disagrees with me. These are some characteristics. If I'm defensive, I'm revealing my inner attitude that says there's no possible way that I can be wrong. So if a brother or sister, perhaps even one of the pastors, comes to me to share something they feel perhaps I'm overlooking or I need in my life, do I respond with defensiveness? Or do I quietly listen? And am I truly hearing what they're saying? Am I making sure that I understand what they're saying? And do I thank them for coming to me? And then most of all, do I examine myself for the Lord to receive what He desires for me to receive? You see, I want to be more like Christ than like Roy Grant. See, how do I respond at those times will make the difference between real growth and real change in my life, or no growth and no change. I've noticed something that's really been a troubling trend, and that is that so many people today, they listen only to respond. They're not listening to learn anything. And while you're trying to get your point across and you're trying to have a heartfelt conversation, they can't wait to jump in my defense. It usually starts out that way. Well, in my defense, that spirit of defensive. You know what the root of that is? It's pride. You see, defensiveness is really ingrained in all of us, because that's what tells us that I'm not wrong. You are. How many times have we walked away in conversation and we've thought that in our minds? Well, I'm just sorry, Pastor, but you just don't get it. I'm not wrong. You're wrong. You'll see. You'll see. You see, it's almost like breathing. We exhibit it even when we don't even know that we're getting challenged, corrected, or rebuked. It's ugly. And really what it is, I'm just going to be plain, it's just really spiritual immaturity in full-blown action. It's pride holding forth a shameful, disgraceful presence when I become defensive. And I'm far, far, far from what Jesus Christ would want me and desire me to be. See, when I look at Jesus, He was never defensive one time in His life, not even once. And He's calling us to put all of this that we discussed tonight, to die to ourselves and become as He becomes. If you could stand to your feet. You see, as Christians, church, we're going to constantly be in a battle with our pride, because we are humanity. I say, well, Pastor, I don't fit but in a very few of these categories. Only takes one. I get frustrated with myself because I look up there and I see a lot of those areas we talked about that I struggle in. Brother James, I want to be like Jesus. I want to have not just a breakthrough in one area of my life. I want to have a complete, total meltdown inside my heart, inside my mind. I want Jesus to come in and change me from the inside so it reflects on the outside. I want to be a better pastor. I want to be a better husband, a better friend. But he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. How does this happen? We have to submit ourselves before God. And we don't like to do that. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God and he will draw nigh unto you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners. And purify your hearts, ye double-minded. I want to open up this altar tonight. As we enter into this second half, perhaps tonight has brought forth some things in your life that you need to address. As you're fasting in prayer, as your flesh gives way to your spirit, I pray that God would open up our hearts and open up our minds to those things that we've hidden away so deep inside. God would allow us to literally regurgitate those things out of our spirits.